Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3 a.m.
This could be the podcast that changes your life. Sleep doesn't just make up a third of our lives, it's vital to drive the other two-thirds in the right direction. Children change it, but there are ways that you can get more for both parent and child. Today, Dr. Sarah and I speak with Dr. Michael Farquhar, a sleep consultant at the Evelina London Children's Hospital.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
Mike, thanks for coming on.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Does everybody just ask you sleep questions all the time?
Absolutely. I try very much to avoid it in a social context if I can. But yes, everyone's interested in sleep. One of the things, everybody sleeps. Lots of people have normal sleep problems. Everybody wants to talk about sleep. So yes.
I think it is the holy grail of parenting. You must get asked all the time.
And with that, so we often get people rocking into our clinic who've been told, oh, go and see the magic sleep doctor. They'll fix everything. And I would love to be able to do that. But sadly, there isn't really any magic.
It's not being realistic.
Lots of sleep is about being realistic and about giving everybody the best chance to get the best possible sleep. But unfortunately, there is no magic. The day there is, I will be very rich.
I like the idea that you're called the magic sleep doctor.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed that on my name badge. I did ask. Sleep wizard I tried for, but no, not allowed.
Should we start off with talking about kind of newborn sleep there? Nothing's normal, is it?
It's normal for them. But it's very different to how adults sleep, and that's often a big issue. To put that in context, there was a study published end of last year, beginning of this year, that says that if you're the parent of a newborn, it will take, on average, until your child is about 6.5 years old before your sleep gets back to the pattern that it was in before the baby was born. And that assumes you don't have another one in the meantime.
Wow.
So babies disrupt sleep. Their sleep is very different to older children and adult sleep. And that means there has to be a very pragmatic adaptation of everybody so that everybody gets the best possible outcomes, bearing in mind that most parents are also trying to get to work and do normal things in the daytime the next day.
Is there a normal duration cycle, though, that people should be kind of looking out for?
Yes and no. So one of the things about sleep is that everyone's always looking for those exact numbers of, you know, you must get X amount of sleep per night for adults and children and babies. There's a huge range of normal. So just like babies pop out and they've got a big range of normal birth weight, when babies are born, they have a kind of genetic background that will tell you how much sleep they need. And some babies will get by on relatively little sleep, still more than adults and older children, and some will need quite a lot of sleep. And at the extremes, there can be quite a big difference of that. So the long sleeping babies may be sleeping for 16, 17 hours out of 24. Those parents are going, woohoo, cracked it, this is easy. Some of the shorter sleeping babies may be sleeping as less as 10 hours in a 24-hour period, and that will be disrupted, intermittent, broken sleep. And if you've got a baby who sleeps like that naturally, then your sleep is going to be much more disrupted than if you're a baby who's sleeping longer.
I want a 16-hour baby sleep.
Ah, well, there you go.
Doesn't everyone?
Well, yeah, I think so. The other thing is it's very different than families. So, you know, people often get lulled into false sense of security by a first baby who is a, in inverted commas, good sleeper. And then the second one comes along and they just sleep differently. And then often there's this then focus then saying, well, there must be something wrong with baby number two because baby number one, we're doing exactly the same thing, but baby number two is not sleeping as well or as long. So there must be something wrong. And usually there isn't. It's just that range of normal. Everybody ends up a different height. Everybody ends up having a different amount of sleep that they need. And that tracks through from birth all the way through.
You kind of are jealous of those parents though, weren't you? It's like when, you know, when little Elderflower comes around and she sleeps for, you know, 18 hours a day and yours only sleeps for 9.
I think
you never have that adult time.
The bigger issue is it's more than just jealousy though. It's because if your friends are saying, oh yes, well, Elderflower is sleeping perfectly and you feel like you're doing everything right. So parents are sleep deprived. It comes with the job, unfortunately. But it means that you start questioning yourself. You're already sleep deprived. You're already more likely to feel anxious and depressed and worried and stressed and irritable and all the rest of it. So you then feel that you must be doing something wrong. The more tense you get about the fact that your baby's not sleeping as perfectly as Elderflower, the more your baby will pick up on those cues and the less good sleep they will get. And then the worse their sleep gets, the worse everything gets. So it often leads into this very negative cycle. It often goes. So obviously we're talking about a time as well when new mothers are very much at risk of conditions like postnatal depression. And I'm absolutely convinced that sleep deprivation is very much a risk factor for things like that. So it all becomes this very complex picture where often people will be pointing a finger and saying, if you can just fix my baby's sleep, everything else will be better. But the problem is fixing sleep often needs that much wider approach to things to try and work out everything that's going on. And some of it is underpinned by basic physiology.
Parents want to know how to establish a healthy sleep mm-hmm. pattern from the beginning. Can you tell us just a bit about the background to sleep in babies and just to help support that?
So I guess the most important thing about sleep in newborns is that humans are a bit weird. We are born at a point in our development much earlier than most other mammal species. So a newborn foal pops out, pops up on its legs and will sort itself out to go and find some food. Mm. Newborn infants are very dependent. We are much more dependent than most other equivalent mammalian species. And part of the reason for that is that we are born before our brain has really got to the development point that those animals are the equivalent of. If we waited till that point to be born, we would never get out of the birth canal. So there are compromises that we've made from an evolution perspective. So what's happening in that first year of life in particular is sleep is supporting that massive growth and development of the baby's brain. And you see that reflected, so as paediatricians, we see it in the growth of the head. You know, the head circumference increases massively in that first year of life. And that underpins growth of the brain and development of the brain. And that is underpinned by the baby equivalent of dream sleep. Mm. As adults, you will spend about 20% of the night roughly in dream sleep. Babies spend over 50% of their time in dream sleep. It's REM equivalent. It's a little bit...
What was that?
Rapid eye movement, dream sleep.
Right.
Which is really important for lots of reasons. But in babies, it's really helping support that growth and development. So 50% of their sleep is helping them to do that bit. Mm. And also that's why so newborn infants will not go longer than maybe 2-3 hours right at the very beginning. Small stomachs, they need calories, they need energy. All that energy is being directed towards that growth and development of the brain as well. And that's all supported by sleep. So sleep is essential in the first year of life, in particular. It's essential at every stage of life, but that, particularly in that first year. We sleep in cycles. So again, as adults, you will sleep in a cycle that's probably about 90 minutes long. Newborn infants sleep in shorter cycles. It's probably about 45 minutes. And it's unusual for newborns to go longer, especially when they're first born, than maybe about 2-3 hours before they will wake and need to feed. I think we evolved learning to smile quite early on because, you know, when your sleep's being interrupted every 2-3 hours, the only thing that stops you going, is the fact that your baby is now giving this really cute smile. You're like, oh, aren't they cute? Mm. But yeah, the cycles are shorter and they don't go so long in consolidated sleep. The things that parents can do, though, to really start to try and get to the point where that holy grail of by the time they get to one, you hope they're sleeping consistently through the night. So from the age of about 6 to 8 weeks, so quite young, babies' brains can start to respond to the cues that help us to decide that we want to be awake in the daytime and asleep at nighttime. And that's all to do with our circadian rhythm, our body clock. And
6 months?
6 weeks. 6 to 8 weeks. It's all tied into the hormone melatonin helps us, the signal that does that. Now, you're not going to get a 6 to 8 week old baby sleeping through the night. But what we encourage people to do is from that age to start to build the cues around a sleep routine. So you start to, around about the nighttime sleep, you start to do that consistent routine, you know, the bath, the winding down, your favourite song, moving to the bedroom, doing everything in the same way, building a routine. And the really important thing is that once you're getting into that nighttime, it's lowering the levels of light. Light tells your brain you want to be awake. And one of the difficulties is if you're awake feeding at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, it feels like an okay thing to do, to switch on the light as you do that.
Don't.
But every time you do that, you're telling the baby's brain that it's daytime. So the more you do that, the longer it's going to take to establish a day-night differential, and that will delay any development of consolidated nighttime sleep.
I think this is actually what scares me the most about becoming a dad, the lack of sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're really not very honest about it at all. So every parent is going to be sleep deprived to some degree. And if you speak to friends who have had kids and they've got to that kind of 7, 8, 9 years now, and then say, what do you remember about the first 5 years? And often their memories are quite hazy. Yeah, it's all a bit of a blur. And a lot
deliberate.
Of that is sleep deprivation, I think, that ties into that.
I think this is also probably one of the things that we get the most. Well, Sarah gets the most. They don't text me. Sarah gets the most questions on. And you've got a couple, haven't you, that people have actually asked us to ask Mike?
So one of the things that I, from my understanding, if correct me if I'm wrong, is that babies who experience more daylight in the day, so for example, if they're outside in the afternoon, that can also improve sleep at night because it's also a again, helping with the circadian rhythm. Yeah.
So that's true for all of us. The more natural light exposure we get in the daytime, the stronger that kind of wake signal, the stronger the wake signal is in the daytime, the more strength there is to the sleep signal at nighttime. It's a simple way of thinking about that. We can take that back a step further. So you and I both have experience of looking after babies born prematurely. Although they are born significantly early, many of them, they start to develop in a similar way in some aspects as term babies. So if we look at the levels of light in neonatal units, the babies who are in neonatal units that have clear distinctions between periods of light and periods of darkness, compared to babies who are nursed in neonatal units where there's just a kind of constant level of light, if we look at their patterns of sleep 3 months later, the babies who were nursed in units that have alternating light cycles are generally better than those who were in constant light exposure. Yes. So yeah, absolutely. There are lots of little tricks like that about sleep.
So the things to think about for parents in the evening is, for example, not overstimulating them, trying to wind down.
Yeah. It's one of the real temptations, I think, of being a parent is that, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning and your baby's wide awake and wanting to play and you're like, oh, this is great. And all that. The natural response is sometimes to respond to that.
Yeah.
But actually, one of the things you can try and do is keep that distinction as much as possible so that daytime is when you're doing active stimulating play and nighttime as much as possible is relaxing and calm and all the rest of it. It's never going to work out perfectly. And the other thing is we very much try and say, so although one of the real keys about sleep is about routine and consistency, it shouldn't be a straitjacket.
No.
The last thing you want to do is think, oh my God, we went to bed at 7:30 instead of 7:15 and that means everything's going to be wrong for the next. So it has to be flexible. Otherwise, you just end up beating yourself up. And
but is going to bed earlier better?
Depends on you. So everybody, again, has their own natural timing. So most people know if they're a morning lark type person or a night owl. So the morning larks are up with the larks and do all their best work. Night owls do their... And that's, again, genetic and innate. And your babies will have their own natural differences as well. So it's about learning them. A lot of good sleep in babies is about really learning to recognise the cues in your baby of when they're sleepy. And that's the kind of thing, you know, so the kind of things that you can be told. But actually, within a few weeks, in a few days, parents very quickly become experts in their own children and they are able to. So it's about giving them the information to pick that up and then build the baby's sleep routine around the natural cues as much as you can, because that's going to give the baby the best chance of having a cycle that fits.
I think some babies get themselves overtired.
Yeah, absolutely.
If cues are missed, and actually can make it harder for them to go to sleep.
Yeah. And again, that often ties into, so for any of us, again, so the overtiredness, the example I always give is overtired toddlers. You know, try and get an overtired toddler to go to sleep, it's a nightmare. But yeah, when you're overtired, it's much more difficult to settle. The babies then become much more frantic. If you are acutely sleep deprived, you are very much hardwired to the distress of your baby. So you become much more upset. The more upset you are, the more upset the baby becomes. You will again be very familiar. One of the magic skills of paediatricians is that we are usually able to take a crying baby, as long as the baby's not actually really sick, but just a crying, overstimulated baby, we can take them and they miraculously calm within a few minutes. And the only reason that works is because, this is going to sound terrible, I'm not emotionally attached.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't care, but I'm not that stressed. My every nerve in my body is not jangling at the thought of hearing this particular baby's cry. So I'm much more calm. The baby calms and off they go to sleep. Whereas parents are much more tuned to that natural cry and distress, and makes everything amplify.
If your baby is crying, though, every 1 to 2 hours during the night, is there something that you can do? Because you're just going to be so worked up, so stressed. Yeah. You're going to just want you want a quick fix, but yeah. I imagine there isn't one.
Often there isn't. And one of the, again, lots of normal ranges of difference between babies, and some babies are just... And again, this sounds terrible, but some babies just cry more than other babies. And again, parents are often very convinced that there must be something wrong. And usually there's not. And obviously, so the big caveat with all of this is that if you're worried about your baby's health and baby is crying, it is important to have that conversation with your health visitor, your GP, your practice nurse, paediatrician if needed, just to make sure there isn't something. But usually there's not. And then it's about supporting families to be able to, first, to understand that and feel confident in that, which is often really tricky. And then it's often a bit about tag teaming, you know, so if and so this sounds terrible as well, it's often mums that have the even more amplified response, and maybe dad does a bit more of that nighttime settling. In some families, it can mean gran comes and stays for a week and gives a bit of support. In Australia, they've got this brilliant resource. It's an organisation called Trezillion, where if you're getting to that point, you can actually just book yourself in to supported accommodation for a period of time.
Wow.
And do it, which we don't really have anything quite like that here.
Yeah. Well,
it's a great idea. Because
so how does that work then?
So again, it's a charitable organisation. So I worked in Sydney for a while. It's run, someone I know is from Sydney. But it's about that spiral. And if you are in that situation, you're sleep deprived, baby's sleep is awful, because you're sleep deprived and stressed, the baby doesn't settle, baby gets more upset, and it just keeps spiraling. So it's about saying, look, why don't we nip this in the bud and try and break that? So you admit somebody into a supported environment where there are other people around who, if the baby's crying, you can say, well, I'll take the baby for a couple of hours, you go and get some sleep. And it feels safe to do that. And often with a 5 or 7 night admission, you can turn things around. But we just don't have the resources to do things like that.
Yeah.
We don't resource the people who should really be helping support parents to do this. So health visitors, brilliant, but there's not enough of them to do this kind of work.
I'm just, if it's okay, going to go back to the 40-minute cycles you were talking about with sleep. I think it's quite an important point to make that with the 40-minute cycles, that means that the baby's waking every 40 minutes and they may actually want the same intervention that you gave them to go to sleep in the very first place. So if you're rocking them to sleep, for example, for 40 minutes at the beginning of the night, if they're waking every 40 minutes, they're actually going to potentially want that multiple times. So when the baby gets older, we're going to need to kind of try and reduce that down.
So that's a concept called sleep association. And particularly for newborns and infants, it is there are lots of competing things that tie into that. So if you're breastfeeding your baby, for example, having your baby close to you so that if they wake, you can quickly settle, feed them and put them back. So co-sleeping is an entirely different conversation to have. But, for example, one of the things I think is brilliant is these kind of attached side cots.
Yeah.
So that the cot
next to me.
Next
bought
to
one. Bought one.
Excellent. I think they're brilliant.
You'll find it great.
So it kind of balances. So we do have, in this country and many Western countries, we do have concerns about co-sleeping. In other cultures, so there is a different approach to co-sleeping. It's about safe co-sleeping. There are ways to do it safely, but that's a good compromise, I think, in this country, those kind of things. So there are competing interests like that. If you look at the slightly older child, so you say you've got a two-year-old that settles off to sleep, but they settle to sleep being cuddled by mum or dad on the living room sofa, they fall off to sleep and then you transfer them to their bed. The sleep cycle will be a bit longer in those older children, but you're right, they can potentially wake up at the end of each sleep cycle. They don't always wake up, or not to the point of being obviously awake. And at the beginning, as we get a little bit older, we consolidate our sleep a little bit differently so that we get deep sleep towards the beginning of the night and then lighter sleep and dream sleep towards the end of the night. So it means that when children first go to sleep, they're much more likely to sleep. So if you set them off to sleep at 8 o'clock, between 8 o'clock and midnight-ish, they'll be getting most of their deep sleep and they won't be waking up so much. But after midnight, they're much more likely to wake at those points. And yes, then, if they are then waking up in their bedroom, they're in a different environment, you're not there, their dummies dropped out that they were sucking as they went off to sleep, then on a subconscious level, their brain says something has changed. We think the reason we have those natural arousal points is what the brain is basically doing is saying, am I still safe? Yeah. So, Zog the caveman back in the Stone Age, being unconscious for 8 hours, bad evolutionary idea, saber-toothed tigers, all the rest of it come and eat you. So the sleep-wake point is really just for your brain to say, am I okay? Has something changed? As long as your brain's safe and reassured, you go back to sleep. If you wake up in a different environment, everything's changed, your brain goes, oh my God, saber-toothed tiger, awake, 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 go and find somebody who can protect me, and they start crying, and if they're mobile, they make their way to you. So yeah, so at some point, and that is a very individual thing in families, about some point you have to help children to learn to be able to settle to sleep by themselves, because that gives them the best chance of being able to sustain sleep by themselves as well.
And I guess that makes sense. If I was to wake up in the middle of my garden, having gone to sleep in my bedroom, I would be pretty shocked.
But
I haven't thought about it like that.
Good night the night before.
Yeah, wake up in the shed.
But it's happening on a subconscious level before it becomes conscious. So usually you will wake up multiple times every night and you will not normally be aware of it, because you're awake for about 30 to 60 seconds. You don't get to a point where you're actually fully awake and your brain is reassured, everything's fine, you go back to sleep, you don't remember that you've been awake. When we look at sleep in the lab, parents are always amazed when we tell them how many times their parents have woken and settled back to sleep through the night. Because they're usually coming to our clinic going, my child wakes three times a night. We're going, well, actually, they woke 33 times last night. You know, so 30 times they fell back to sleep. Result. But yeah, people are always surprised by that in terms of how often we wake and settle.
I think one of the things that helped me with Daisy, I mean, this may not be applicable to everyone else, was she was initially feeding to sleep. And actually, when I just woke her slightly and put her back into the cot and she was slightly awake, she knew she was in her cot.
Yeah.
And that was the thing for us that really broke any sleep association.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key recommendations is that exactly that. You want to try and help children to be able to settle into bed awake but sleepy. And then to do that bit of, you know, so the reassurance from parents so that they know that they're safe, they know that they're okay, but for you to be able to come away so they actually get off to sleep without you being physically there. And that decision about when you do that is a very individual decision. It ties into things like if you're breastfeeding, for example, the decision about when you stop breastfeeding or stop night breastfeeding is a very individual choice. So it's about getting the balance right and helping parents to make informed decisions. And when they're ready to make those changes, that they are given information that gives them the best chance of doing it.
What about when it comes to balance? What about daytime naps? You know, how much do we need to be controlling napping in the daytime?
For you or for a child?
I mean, no, we'll take the child first.
So some daytime sleep is normal. So newborns are sleeping, you know, all around the clock pretty much. I say by the time you get to a year, the majority of sleep is usually consolidated into a single long nighttime sleep, maybe a few wakes and settles. But there is usually still some daytime sleep, one or two, three, whatever.
Up to a year.
By the first year. But what then happens over the next few years is those daytime sleeps tend to reduce both in frequency and duration. So for most kids, by the time they get to school, they don't have a need for daytime sleep anymore. But again, in exactly the same way as things like height and weight, there will be some kids who still have a little bit of a need for daytime sleep that might last a little bit longer. So generally, around about the time you get to school, that need for daytime sleep will have gone. Persistence of daytime sleep beyond that without an obvious cause is I'm a paediatric sleep specialist, but from our point of view, a primary school child who's falling asleep in the daytime has a problem.
Right, that's not good to know.
Yeah, that's not normal. Primary school children, more than anybody else at any point in their lives ever, primary school children want to be awake.
Yeah.
Mm. So a primary school child falling asleep in the daytime is a problem.
We kind of joked about it before, and I know you're going to come onto this, but you know, adults sleep as well as the baby sleep. How can we get more? How can we actually get that fine line, that fine divide of? Because I constantly hear people saying all the time, "Oh, you know what? I didn't realise, but I can get by on 6 hours sleep." And everyone's Margaret Thatcher all of a sudden. Yeah. But actually, you know, we're not. Not everyone's like that. I know I am not the type of person who can get by on 4 or 5 hours sleep. So, well, get used to it, Rick. You might be thinking, the type of person, Mike.
No, I fully accept both of those points.
They say that some dads don't actually wake when the baby sleeps.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So this is important. You know,
that kind of
wife's a deep sleeper.
Sharing of responsibilities. So if we're talking about adults before children come along, so the average amount of sleep that an adult needs is probably about 7.5-8 hours. Any adult who is telling you that they can get by on less than 6 hours of sleep is almost certainly kidding themselves. The number of people who can genuinely get by on that amount of sleep is vanishingly small. Some adults need as much as 8, 9, 10 hours of sleep a night.
Yeah, you're speaking to one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is unique to you. So if you need 10 hours of sleep and you get 8 hours of sleep, you are 2 hours sleep deprived every night. If you need 8 hours of sleep and you get 8 hours of sleep, 100%, you feel fine. So two people can get the same amount of sleep and be affected by sleep deprivation differently. So that's a really important point.
And it's so important for our health in the long run.
Oh, absolutely.
It's those chronic diseases which are linked to sleep.
I spend half my time banging this drum. Sleep is the foundation of your health, absolutely. Every aspect of your physical and mental health depends on getting the right amount of sleep. It's usually for adults. So one, it's about not knowing how much sleep you need or not being honest. If you look at how much sleep you get on holiday or at weekend, it's almost certainly longer than what you get in a normal weekday night. That's your body telling you that you're sleep deprived. Do something about it. And then it's about the fact that we've all got really bad habits. You know, we're all up watching Netflix and on our phones and drinking caffeinated drinks and all the rest of it, which are all bad for sleep. So then the quality of the sleep you get is less good as well. And that makes you sleep deprived and grumpy and irritable and short tempered. Sleep makes you a nice person. If you're not getting the right amount of sleep, you're really not the best version of yourself the next day. Threw in a newborn baby into that, and well, sleep is just something from the past now, and it takes a while. I said, you know, 6.5 years probably before parental sleep gets back to.
You're coming out with loads of quotes for posters.
I know. Sorry.
Can I talk about sleep routines and babies?
Yeah.
So there seems to be two camps in parents. There's an extreme, strict, exact time routine a day parents who, by 8:15, if they haven't had a slice of toast the day, they have failed as a parent. And then there's the other who just are very flexible about their time. Yep. What do you recommend to parents?
So I'm going to straddle the line. Flexible consistency.
Yeah.
So the most important thing, so the reason that if you go to the bookshop and look for baby sleep books, you will find 10 million different books and they'll all be saying slightly different things. Mm. And you will always find every single one of those books will have quotes on the back saying, oh my God, this book changed my life. I followed this book. My baby slept. For every single one of those quotes, there'll be another 5-10 families going, yeah, we tried all this. It just didn't work for us. So different things work for different families. Different things work for different babies. And a little bit is about understanding the very basics and then understanding how your family works and also how your baby is, what their natural biology is. And that takes a bit of time. But then you've got to find a sleep style that fits all of that.
Around the family.
So as a general principle, what we encourage is flexible consistency. So as a general rule, routine is important for sleep. Sleep's a habit. And the more that that becomes something that your brain expects, if you do the same things in the same order every night, it's like lining up a plane to land on a runway. You know, the better lined up everything is, the better chance you've got of landing the plane safely. So some routine and consistency is really important for sleep. And going to bed at roughly the same time, getting up at roughly the same time, doing the same things in the same way. But if that becomes a straitjacket, it just becomes something that drives lots of stress and anxiety and worry. So, oh, yeah, same, you know, same thing again. Oh, my God, we went to bed half an hour later. Everything's gone now. And everybody gets very stressed about it. So a little bit of consistency is fine.
So I think one thing that lots of parents get really anxious about is controlled crying.
Yep. So this is all about that idea that at some point you have to separate parental presence from your baby, your child. And that's a very individual decision. There are lots of different ways of doing that. And controlled crying is kind of like the nuclear bomb option. It's the cold turkey. You know, you leave them to settle, you close the door, you let them cry and they'll learn. And actually, and what the evidence tells us is that most babies and children will, over quite a short period of time, will actually manage to do that. And the long-term evidence looking at that suggests that these kids don't have any horrible outcomes as a result. It's like, you know, so it's the people say, oh, well, their stress levels and their cortisol. It's like, well, yes, but if you look at them having a temper tantrum in Tesco saying because they want something, you don't give in to them because you're worried about their cortisol. You say, no, we manage this and do it.
And those studies were done in Romanian orphanages, weren't they?
No. So the good studies were done in Australia that kind of give the evidence against this. However, standing outside a bedroom door listening to your child cry is a horrible experience for many, 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 many people. Really. So there are gradual ways of doing it. So two broad ways of things. We talk about gradual withdrawal, retreat and return. So gradual withdrawal, if your baby is falling asleep, lying next to you holding on, you separate your physical presence, then you gradually move yourself further and further away. Retreat and return, usually with older children, you say, oh, we're just setting up. Say, oh, just remembered, I've got to go and do something next door. You go, you come back. You keep doing that. You increase the times you go away. You increase the length of time you go away. And eventually, usually with a combination of those things, you can do it. So controlled crying is a very extreme version of those separation strategies. And what works for families is a very individual thing. And it's about knowing the options and finding one that works for you.
And a middle ground approach tends to work
pretty well. Very, very quickly, conflict of interest. The only time I've ever done controlled crying was with my niece when she was one. I was home for the Christmas holiday. She hadn't done it. I literally had 4 days to try and help get her sleep sorted. So I did that, sat outside her room with that kind of, please don't kill me, with my mum and my sister son glaring at me. And thankfully it worked. And she's absolutely fine.
And most parents say that 3 days... By usually 3 to 4 days, and it.
Yeah, so many will, but there's no logic, you know, that you can't predict that. And, you know, so it then means that the parents are doing it and it's day four and there's no improvement. They're like, oh my God, we're traumatizing our child for no reason. So both of those things are probably not
variable.
Quite right. But yeah, it's very variable.
You're one of these people who's working when they're not working.
Me? Yeah, I work well. When I'm talking about sleep, I am, yeah.
Two things I've majorly taken from this: constant routine or consistent routine.
Yeah.
And
consistent, flexible routine.
Light.
Yeah.
and low light.
Light is one of the strongest things that influences our wake sleep for all of us. So in the environment we're in just now, so we're sitting in a studio, the light level in here is rubbish. There's not enough light in this environment to stimulate your brain to be properly awake. We need a lot brighter light in the daytime. So lots of light in the daytime, dark at nighttime. We do the exact opposite. We have dim light in all our office environments, and then at night we go home and stick our faces in front of phones that actually give us that bright light at the wrong time.
That's fascinating. I always have the studio really low. I think I like it nice and cozy.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you ever come to a studio with me, Michael, be nice, low, dim, dim light. I find it more relaxing.
I'll be curled up asleep in the corner.
Yeah. Thanks very much for coming on.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been absolutely fascinating. I think people can talk about sleep all day.
I can.
Yeah. Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3 a.m.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.